Welcome to episode 33 of Canthropod, the Cambridge Anthropology podcast, hosting episode 7 of Artery, a podcast on art, authorship and anthropology.
Welcome to Artery with Isa Kavegia, a podcast on art, authorship and anthropology. In each episode of this collaborative podcast, one anthropologist, specializing in a particular cultural context, has a conversation with an artist of their choosing, exploring issues of authorship and responsibility in art. In this episode, I have a pleasure of speaking with Emiko Agatsuma, Japanese butoh dancer and choreographer. Emiko is an internationally acclaimed dancer and the recipient of numerous awards, including an award from Japan Dance Critics Association as the Best Young Artist in 2015. She attended Waseda University in Tokyo, and upon her graduation in 1999, she joined the butoh company Dairakudakan. She had performed in every Dairakudakan production until 2019, under the directorship of the company founder, Akaji Maro. In 2014, she performed and directed a piece called Niku no Uta at Kochuten Theatre in Tokyo and afterwards in Paris, in Japan Cultural Center in 2015. It is there that I met her and seen her perform for the first time. Emiko, could you please tell our listeners a little about yourself, please?
Of course,
thank you for having me. I'm Emiko Agatsuma. I'm Japanese. I do a type of dance called butoh. Butoh is an avant-garde dance form that was born in Japan around the 1960s. It's a dance that incorporates the ancient traditions and movements of Japan, such as its traditional festivals and foods. And it's a genre that has continued to influence young dancers and artists throughout the world. I've been doing butoh for about 20 years now.
Can you tell me a little about one of your recent works, the Otera Odori Ocha session?
Sure, the Otera Odori Ocha session is a recent collaborative piece that brings together the Japanese tea ceremony and the butoh theatre, and is performed in a Japanese Buddhist temple. This performance explores how these three Japanese cultural traditions can influence each other and give birth to new forms of Japanese expression. As a project that we will work on and develop year on year, these three elements work together as a kind of team rather than as a single piece, overlapping and affecting each other in different ways.
So, how did this piece come about? What gave you the impetus to start working on it?
With the Otera Odori Ocha session, there was a particular person who brought us all together, who is really fond of ceramics like those used in the Japanese tea ceremony. Incidentally, in ceramics, while many see beauty in symmetry, there can also be an appreciation for works that are asymmetrical or warped in some way. We use the term wabi-sabi to refer to beauty that is found in the imperfect. And it's the view that something is more interesting if it is flawed. This uniquely Japanese appreciation for beauty in asymmetry is also present in butoh, which sparked our interest. So with the Japanese tea ceremony, which has also inherited this Japanese wabi-sabi aesthetic, we first put on the performance at a festival that was held at a temple called Zojoji Temple near Tokyo Tower, which is a temple that enshrines Tokugawa Ieyasu. That was our first encounter. Although we know of these traditional cultures, those of us living in the present day are also breathing the air of a new Japan. So we are applying ourselves to developing a modern wabi-sabi or imperfection that's not too restrained by tradition, in the hope that we will be able to influence the world at large.
Oh, that is fascinating. What was your experience of collaboration? Was it quite straightforward or were there some challenges too?
There weren't as many difficulties as I thought there would be, and we're mostly just having fun while we work. With the Japanese tea ceremony, there are many strict rules, but what we're doing is trying to find ways to disrupt this. That doesn't mean that we ignore the rules or violate etiquette. We're not going out of our way to disrespect people. But where people are excessively abiding by the rules and the atmosphere is too tense, we're trying to take it to a more casual place by going back to its roots and how people enjoyed tea back then. So we're really having fun while pulling it apart.
Can you tell me how you planned and prepared for the work Otera Otera de Oja session? Is most of your work choreographed and planned in detail, or is there an element of improvisation?
Although my other works have an element of improvisation, in the case of the Otera Odori Ocha session, this was planned in detail, step by step. This planning is different to the usual dance-only choreography, in that we also conduct the tea ceremony Otemai, the ritual of greeting the guest and conducting the ceremony, and serving them. For example, when we present the tea, we rotate the tea bowl 3 times. Although the tea bowl is rotated carefully 3 times, when we take a component like this and turn it into a piece of choreography, we deform it and give it an element of risk or danger. Although last year, before the COVID pandemic, we had guests actually attend and enjoy the tea and sweets, we're planning another one for November, which will need to be altered in response to these times. For this, we'll plan it out and then train for about a month. We'll work on the same movements for a month, myself and Shioya, the other Butō dancer. There's also the tea master and 2 priests. None of the other 3 are dancers, of course, so it will take time to teach them the choreography and to train them.
So the Buddhist priests perform the dance too?
Yeah, so desu ne.
Right. Butō movement is different to Western dance, where you dance along to the music. It's closer to the rituals of the priests, like the slow actions of prayer. The movements are very deliberate, and we'll be distorting these movements and creating the choreography in this way.
This process of distorting and transforming and collaborating is quite interesting. That reminds me, I wanted to ask you about your work in progress with Kawanami-san. What is this new work you are preparing?
Kawanami Yukie-san is a bandoneon player. Do you know of the bandoneon? It's an instrument often used for Argentine tango, a little bit like the accordion. It is said to be a pretty difficult instrument to play. There aren't many players in the world, as it's too difficult and people get put off practicing it. Apparently, it's called the devil's instrument. Kawanami Yukie-san has been familiar with the bandoneon from an early age and has been creating his own works. He gives incredibly energetic tango performances with it too. Obviously, Butō is a completely different genre of dance to tango. But there was a vision that we shared. With Butō and the music of the bandoneon, there are emotions that rise up from the inside. They might be messy, or things that we end up enduring within, that we can't put into words, like sadness, anger, or things that make us really laugh. We decided to do a collaboration that delivers these through sound and through the body. The bandoneon is strongly associated with tango, but what we are pursuing together are new associations, new expressions that are not arrested by this image of tango.
This new piece is a collaboration, not only with Kawanami-san, right? But also in a sense with the public or the audience members, am I right? Can you tell me more about this?
When we create a piece of work together, if we discuss the world we want to conjure up by ourselves, just the 2 of us, we end up restricting ourselves to this tiny 2-person world. So we've created a public survey that asks people to name the oldest song that exists in their memory. It could be a song I'm familiar with, it could be a really old song that I've never heard, or conversely, a recent song from a newer generation, or depending on the country, it could be a song that we don't know at all. And because it's a public survey, it's not just for named participants or friends. And we asked them what created this memory. People have all kinds of experiences, and at times an experience stays in the memory, and at times it escapes our memory. What is the song that still remains with you from when you were young? When asked this, they start to think about it for the first time, and in this way we stimulate their imagination, which in turn stimulates our process. So we're open to what it might bring, without deciding on an end goal and having a plan, or trying to control it.
Can you tell me a little bit more about this process of allowing yourself to be influenced by the potential audience members? How do you take this on? In what way?
Well, we're still at the stage of collecting the surveys and sharing with each other how we feel when we read them. So it hasn't become a dance or sound yet. The important thing is to hear about these things that can't be seen, like memory, things that aren't visible to the eye. I'm a dancer, so the images from when they were young enter into me, and if that song from their memory is a little sad, I start wondering why they remembered it, and it's like I'm entering into their dream. So without being shackled by my own experience, I let my body become like an intermediary. Like we often do in workshops, emptying the self and then letting other people's experiences come in. The historical backdrop, their experiences of poverty. Of course, it's a form of fiction, but it's a sensation of connecting a dream to a dream. I don't think it's necessary to stay in reality or stick to your own experience. And when connecting within the dream, at times we synchronize, at times it's the total opposite. This brings about new movements in the body. That's what I'm hoping for. This input or ideas from other people is essential to me.
And how about your solo pieces? For example, Future Temple. What was the process of making it?
Future Temple was created in Taiwan last year, from February to March 2020. It was during a three-month artist-in-residence program in Taipei, and I had a vague plan during this residency period to check out the culture of Taiwan and go about making it from there. The entryway to the location of the artist-in-residence program happened to be a large temple, so you would pass through the temple to go into the village. And when I passed through, I noticed that this temple in Taiwan, even though it's the same Buddhist temple that we have in Japan, was totally different. Japanese Buddhist temples are quite chic, monochrome, and sophisticated. They're not so flashy. But Taiwanese temples are really lively and colourful, with yellows and reds and greens. And as I was passing through this temple, I started to think that what I was feeling being here in Taiwan, of things being somewhat similar but somehow different, could become a piece of work. From there, I started to look into Taiwanese festivals. And at the same time, what was on my mind was this idea about the people of my generation not being very religious. Though my parents' generation would habitually go to visit graves and customarily believe in a god. In my case, I celebrate Christmas, and on New Year's, I go to a shrine, and if someone dies, I visit their grave. So my generation doesn't believe in a specific god. That's my generation. So then for the next generation and the one after that, how do they imagine a god or pray for their ancestors? Future Temple contemplates these changes to conventions over time. In ancient times, for instance, we would feel God in something in nature, like a large tree that had accumulated its years. And from these trees, we'd build Buddhist statues and pray to these statues made from the trees. But then as years passed, there's the opinion that plastic is more resilient and better as a material. and so we would worship statues made from plastic. These occurred because of changes to our environment. How do we discuss the feelings and problems we can't solve? Well, there are no answers to that. But imagine in 1,000 years' time, and no one's telling you how to pray to God. If I was suddenly in that place, how would I experience God? How would I pray to those who have passed away? Future Temple looks at this. It's complicated. Because of the internet, we can look up anything nowadays. If you're ill, for example, if you have a headache or a fever, you can look up these symptoms and the search engine tells you what disease you might have. And if the internet comes up with all the answers, then can we consider information as God? I feel we're in this situation now where human beings and more superior beings are going back and forth. That's what this work is about. It's tricky. It's about religion, a new religion. It's a time when we can't have faith solely in one thing. We can't believe that one thing is absolutely right. That's where we are. But there is still a concept of God.
This interface between religion and art is very interesting. Somehow exploring this spiritual boundary space between religion and art.
When I came to Taiwan, I was really inspired. In the temples, there are Buddhist statues, and then next to that are Taoist deities. And that's normal, to worship both in one temple. It's a god of a different religion in the same temple. And in some, there are statues of these angels with wings and oriental faces. I guess they were erected under the influence of Christianity. And so nothing is rejected, but it's all blended together, all the history and culture. It's letting everything exist. I found that fascinating. The people who visit these temples may be worshipping different gods to each other, but they don't refuse the other. They're just gently existing together.
This kind of creative process reminds me a little of anthropology. As anthropologists, we also put other people's practices and perspectives at the heart of our research. While philosophers might focus on rigorous thinking at their own desk, perhaps, anthropologists also prefer to take other people's way of thinking and doing things as our point of departure. So your process reminds me of anthropological work in some ways.
thank you. And in my case, it's okay to be wrong. My research outcomes can be hit or miss. I'm enjoying that part too. For example, by setting a piece in the future, you have the freedom to go to a place where the answer isn't decided. I love to research, and ideally I want to open up its potential, not just by presenting that research, but by changing its shape somehow.
That is so interesting, this changing shape. How does that take place in your process? Do you take ideas from various places and combine them? How would you describe that transformation?
Combining ideas, yes. When I investigate temples, I look into temples and other things like everyday food culture. I look at YouTube and what the youth of today are doing. I don't know if that's accurate to say. Anyway, that is a mixture of fact and fiction. So I try to get information from as many sources as possible. And by doing so, I unconsciously end up changing, even if I didn't plan to. There's that element to it.
To step back a little, could you tell me a little about your everyday practice, how you go about things?
Well, I don't have a particular image or purpose when I make something. It's quite hazy, but there is a kind of a shadow of a movement in my mind. So first I try acting that out with my body, which leads to another movement, a bit like an association game. I always start off by researching, right? And then from this research, my brain fills up and becomes quite chaotic. And then I start to see vague traces of movements. So then I use my physical body and start moving, which opens up other possible movements. And I just keep linking up these movements without any feeling of responsibility. And because it's without responsibility, it can be quite uninteresting. But from these uninteresting movements, I return to the research and then I make adjustments. Like under these conditions, it can be tighter here, or this movement should be more rigid. I go back and forth, sometimes letting it expand out and sometimes making cuts to it.
Do you use some kind of note-taking or recording in this process? How do you keep track of your thoughts?
So back in the day, before I had a smartphone, I used a notebook. And then I'd make notes on movements, like 10 seconds here, however many seconds here, etc. Everything got written down, and the image I had in my mind would be put into words. Now I still put it into words, but I can now also take videos, which I can watch back and get ideas of how I can better move my body. But I have to be careful about this, because if you believe the image too much, then there is a danger of it becoming too superficial. And the reason for that is because watching something on a stage and watching it on a small screen are totally different. So not believing that what you see on the small screen is everything, as it then becomes something that only looks a certain way. So I use this as a resource for reference, but obviously it's not everything. And the important thing is the change that occurs inside when you dance. How does this change occur? Or how does it become constricted? That is what is most important to me when I'm working on a piece.
You touched upon this earlier a little, but I wanted to ask you a little more about this anyway. When you're making something, planning a performance, do you sometimes feel like the ideas are coming from elsewhere or feel compelled to pursue a line of thought?
When I plan something, I generally collect information without judging whether it's going to be useful or not, whether it's going to result in an idea. And so there's this jumble of information. And there are certainly times when ideas don't come. And in those times, I might research extensively through the internet or I go to a particular location. And then at times I just give up. I take a walk or go somewhere that is unrelated to dance to empty myself. And then it comes up suddenly. And in those cases, I may have been thinking about it subconsciously, but I try to give myself a break. And I'm conscious not to restrict my field of vision too much. When I start something, I'm the type of person who zones in on something, so my body and my mind get tired, but I'm convincing myself that I have to think about it some more. So then I resolve to go outside. I like to jog, so I go running, and while I'm running, I'm not thinking of anything. I sweat and it feels good. That's all. And then sometimes when I get back, I realize, oh, maybe it's like this. So this moment of becoming empty is important. Taking a breather from being kind of stuck and unable to breathe to this great exhale where I gain perspective.
So in one of your Bhutto workshops, you suggest that participants perform a movement that is based on the image of water filling up a body gradually, a body that is itself empty. And the body then does not move consciously, so to speak, but it is rather moved by the water. I was wondering if the ideas are a little bit like that. Do they also enter one from outside? And if so, then what is the responsibility? What is the role of the artist? Is it to channel these ideas?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I haven't thought about it in that way. And now that you ask me, I'm thinking about it for the first time. I think I'm always absorbing ideas. Like this conversation. We're talking, and I'm absorbing something from you, Izza. And then when I eat, I'm constantly absorbing, whether it's tasty or not, how beautiful this colour is. It's not related to dance, and it doesn't all become a dance, but there are elements that can't help but get included in my dance. Sometimes I'll go to watch someone else's performance, and then that is connected to dance. I might go to see some paintings or enjoy some music, and these are all other people's ideas. All the same, I can't absorb it all. Things that I'm drawn to filter through, and then even things that I dislike. If I judge that I don't like it, by vocalizing that to myself, it sticks. The things that are forgotten are probably in the middle. I don't like or dislike them, and they just pass through me. The things that I've experienced and have stayed with me, stuck with me, they all become mixed into my life cycle. And because my life cycle is different to yours, we're absorbing different things and we have different tastes, etc., different things leave an impression on us. And I think our perspectives on the world are formed by these things. And then, because it's impossible to copy someone perfectly, whatever concerned you at the time sticks with you. So then we have this mashup, this rearrangement of element A from over here and element B from over there, and then C from over here. This becomes B, C, A, or maybe it becomes C, A, B, and that becomes my work. Maybe this leaves an impression on other people, or it goes right through them without leaving a mark. What an artist does is pass it on. An idea is probably never completely yours, right? Is it? Human beings live within relationships, and from the moment we use language, we're using something that's not ours, something that we haven't created ourselves. I'm speaking Japanese right now, under the influence of Japan and its culture. I think the role of the artist is to, with the filter that they have, take these different influences, break it down, mix it all up, and then take certain elements of that to create a new piece of work.
What are you excited about right now? What are you thinking about at the moment?
Last year, Taiwan wasn't too badly affected by the pandemic, so we could move about quite freely. Having just arrived in Taiwan again, I'd assumed that it would be the same again this year. But the situation is different, and I haven't really reacted by thinking, oh no, this thing is no longer possible. My hope is that I can find a new way of looking at things. I'm someone who's always worked in the theatre, but that's difficult under these current conditions. It's difficult to gather an audience. Some people are publishing videos on YouTube, and so there's this new movement. Well, I guess it's no longer new, but there's been these dramatic changes to theatre and stage performances, and that's changing us performers, and it will probably change the audience members too. Even if we continue to do the same thing on stage, people wouldn't want to come because of the risk of infection. And then again, movement between countries is extremely restricted, so that's affecting international collaborations. And what we can and can't do has to be renegotiated. This doesn't make me feel pessimistic, though. The situation calls for new ways of doing things. Some things can't be done, so in turn, let's do this. I think there'll be more and more of this kind of thinking.
Do you have preferred places where you spend time to develop new ideas?
New ideas. Basically, I love spending time alone. Even when I'm at home, I make time to be by myself. So my favourite place ends up being my own room. Otherwise, when I'm in Tokyo, there aren't many green spaces, so I'll go somewhere like the park. I generally like moving around rather than being in one place. And what I really love is the sea. There's nowhere close by, so I have to make the effort to go, though. I love looking at the sea.
You used to work with a large Buto group, Daira Kudaka, both dancing and choreographing. So what are some similarities and differences in the process of choreographing something for a large group or just for yourself, for your own performance?
With Daira Kudakan, when we all dance together, it's not my creation, so I have to speculate, what are they asking of me? The last piece we did together was called Notare, and my role in that was a strolling entertainer. We all had roles, so when I'm told, you'll be playing the part of a strolling entertainer, regardless of whether that's something I want to do, I start researching it. And because it was a large group, it usually wasn't me dancing by myself. And in a group dance with five others, you have to be a lot more conscious of the overall space, as well as the sensations of your own body. Simply put, it's about aligning our choreographed movements. I was focusing most not on standing out with my own body, but on how we can shape the space together. You have to be mindful of your own dancing and simultaneously on the dancing of the other five, and additionally, the kind of atmosphere they want to create. We did that through repeated training, going over it again and again to improve the accuracy of our dancing. At times, there'd be someone who'd need to be cautioned because they were too self-centered in their dancing. And why can't they be self-centered in their dancing? We then have to reason with them and get them to realize that the whole mood of the dance can get distorted from that. We often do this in workshops, allowing the motion of the waves to move you. And if during the session, one person is still moving at their usual speed, it disrupts the mutual image we have of the wave. And so when dancing within a group, that communication about the pace and the overall sense of space is vital. The difficulty here is to get the other person to recognize the importance of this. That's really tricky. When it's a solo performance, it's just you and your body that needs to have that spatial awareness. That's enough. And in that way, it's easier to have control if you're dancing solo. But on the other hand, you can overindulge and let yourself get away with things, and that can be really unappealing. And it becomes up to you to observe and stay attentive to this. Your vision has to be based on something other than your own body, because our bodies have a tendency towards what comes easiest, and so working on your own is difficult unless you have a firm idea of the world you want to create and not pander to the tendencies of your own body.
This image of another world is very interesting. It reminds me of the relationship between the space and atmosphere, an atmosphere that is created between people, including the audience. What is the role of the audience in your pieces? Is it important?
Well, the audience is crucial. And because they themselves aren't dancers, some will be watching in a particular way, whilst others may be sleeping. And there are also those who are constantly fidgeting. But whoever they happen to be, what counts is the fact that they are here and sharing this space with you. And when I'm dancing, I can't clearly see what each audience member is doing. But there is this sensation of the audience being a certain distance away. When I'm expressing myself, when I'm dancing, I'm aware of whether I'm trying to convey something to someone 3 meters away from me or 100 meters away. And not just in front of me, but to the side and behind. There are subtle differences in how you express yourself when you're performing in an intimate theatre or outside or in a spacious theatre. Because as a performer, you're taking into account a certain distance or space, and you yourself are being affected by the change in your self-expression. That's why I think video work is really difficult, because you put up a camera and perform in front of it. I'm not great at it. I'm still trying to figure out how to work with it. I'm in the midst of that struggle right now. The presence of an audience, I don't know what it is, but I unknowingly get some kind of energy from that. And it's not that they're verbally encouraging me, just the fact that they're there. I get something from that that's hard to put into words. And I think my presence also throws something out there that's not communicated with words. And some kind of exchange is born. And it's really special, that sense of exchanging information on such a large scale without having a conversation, but just by sharing the same space.
Do you feel a sense of responsibility for your work, for your pieces? And what is the responsibility of the creator, artist, maker?
I do feel a sense of responsibility, yes. When I dance, though, I'm a dancer. Mid-dance, I'm not dancing with a sense of responsibility. But once I've finished, or when I'm introducing that work, I'm already on the outside of it. So then I do feel some responsibility. And also when I invite people to come and see it, I feel responsible for it. So in that way, I believe that it's okay for the dancer to be irresponsible when they're dancing. My take on it is that when I'm dancing, that rational side of me that decides I can't do this or I must do that has been replaced by something else, so I can become that person who can't reason or be responsible. During a performance, it becomes the performer's duty to be in that state. So you could say it's the performer's responsibility to become a person who can't take responsibility. But when you're introducing that work, what is the responsibility then? I guess to be able to explain it properly, to be able to convey the concept, that's one. And also for me, I'm careful not to exclude anyone, to be prejudiced in any way. I guess we can class that as responsibility, as it's not on good form. But my personality is divided. The artist is free to do what they like, even be a character under horrible conditions like a criminal when on stage. But when that's being released as a piece of work that's going to be seen by many people, when taking on the role of a director, say, as I do, a different duty, a social obligation is born, right? It's the same person. I'm still the same Emiko Agatsuma, but I have to produce a different character with obligations from my social connections and contracts. This issue of responsibility is a tricky one, where the social awareness is separate to the art.
Another interesting issue is the issue of responsibility for the artwork, in a way. Once the artwork has been born, it takes up a life of its own, not unlike a child that leaves home. How can we understand artist responsibility in that sense? Perhaps one cannot take responsibility for every possible impact the artwork might have.
Dance is a form of expression without words, and there may be times when you're unintentionally hurting someone. Even though that's not your intention, you're bringing ill feeling towards someone. And I think that's your responsibility. But can you really refrain from doing anything and just live happy and positive? I think that as a human being, you're not being true then, and that's another responsibility. We have to understand that not everyone can be in agreement all the time about responsibility. The reason we don't like responsibility is because we're then culpable. People say, "Why did you do that?" or "You shouldn't have done that." We get accused or blamed. That's why we're so averse to responsibility. But that's part and parcel of living and communicating. Not being able to hold yourself accountable for something, even though you feel responsible, is another common problem, I think. But you can't reach the other person by being too gentle. It doesn't resonate if you blur it out too much. But if it's too edgy, then you end up hurting some people.
Thank you so much, Emiko, for this wonderful conversation. It was a real pleasure talking with you.
I enjoyed this immensely. Usually I'm using vague intuition and movement, so I don't often have the opportunity to converse using words. So it's great to sometimes organize these thoughts in my head by putting them into words. Thank you so much, Iza.
This was Artery with Iza Kavegia, a podcast on art, authorship and anthropology, supported by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council. Hope to speak with you again soon.